This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Which Sandra asked this morning in the shiur, and to explain the question, I've just got to give you a little bit of the shiur which I gave the ladies this morning. There's a bit of a discrepancy in two psukim in this morning's sedra. It says, "Vayehi b'chodesh harishon b'shono hashemis be'echad l'chodesh," and it was on the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month. That's on the first of Nisan. Hukam haMishkan. The Mishkan was established. It was built. And then in the very next sentence, it says, "Vayokem Moshe es haMishkan." Moshe established the Mishkan. Moshe built the Mishkan. The problem is that in the first case it says in the passive form the Mishkan was established, which is difficult enough to understand altogether. How was it established? Who built it? Who erected it? It says it was erected. So we might say it was miraculously erected. Then in the next sentence it says, "Vayokim Moshe es haMishkan." Moshe erected the Mishkan. If he erected the Mishkan, why didn't he tell us that in the first sentence? And say that it was on the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that Moshe erected the Mishkan. There seem to be two things here. There seems to be an aspect of the Mishkan having erected itself, and an aspect of Moshe having erected the Mishkan. Rashi comments on that earlier on in the Sedra, and Rashi says, based on various midrashim, some of which we'll see later on, Moshe took no part in the building of the Mishkan up till this point, so God reserved for him the actual erection of the Mishkan. Moshe said to God, "But how can I do it? Nobody can erect it. It's much too heavy." So God answered, "Don't worry. You busy yourself with it. Make it seem as if you're erecting it, and I'll ensure that it erects itself automatically, that it happens miraculously." So on the one hand, Hukam haMishkan, the truth is it happened miraculously. But Vayakim Moshe, it appeared as though Moshe was establishing it. And I asked on that Rashi, but that's playing games. If they specially reserved the erection of the Mishkan for Moshe, then give him a meaningful role to play. If the Mishkan is going to erect itself and you don't really need anybody and it's going to be a miracle in any event, what's the big thing? This was Moshe's thing. He erected the Mishkan. And why does it say by Yochem Moshe is a Mishkan that Moshe erected it? He didn't erect it. God erected it. So I said, really, this is no different to anything else we do. Whatever we do, whatever we achieve successfully, if one looks at it analytically, it's so difficult that when you look at it retrospectively, you don't know how you did it. And had you known how difficult it was, you wouldn't have even started. That's just how things are. Nothing successful can be achieved without a great deal of siyata dishmaya. One needs God's helping hand. The world is just too difficult to operate without God's helping hand. With God's helping hand, it can be done. And everything is like this. It looks as if we're doing it, and in fact, it's all miraculous. We've got to busy ourselves making look as if we're making a living for ourselves, working and doing all sorts of things. But in fact, when you come to the end of it and you think how it is that you make a living at the end of the month, or how it was that you found that job, or how it is that you're able to handle that job, it's all very strange and miraculous. That's how it is. That's how the whole Bria is. That's how the whole world operates. So Sandra asked a very perceptive question, and she said, where else is this form used? If this is the case, that in all situations, it's only man only appears to be acting, but really it's the Ribbono Shel Olam who's doing all the work, and it's only an appearance. If that's the fact, then ask Sandra, surely it should use this form more often. It should show us the passive and the active form together. Why is this the one case? She said, is there anywhere else in the Torah where this form is used? And I said, as far as I know, there's nowhere else in the Torah where this form is used. Why not? I said, because the Medrash Tanchuma says in this week's Sedra that the Mishkan is a little mini world. It's a model of the world. And the Medrash, one day we'll learn that Medrash. The Medrash goes through each piece of the Mishkan, each piece of the furniture, everything, and shows what it represents in the real world. It's a little model world. It works like a little world. It's a beautiful thing. It's like playing with electric trains. It's a real working model. That's what the Mishkan is. So while we're discussing the creation of a model, that's where we're taught this principle, that when you build the world, it's not you who's building the world, it's God who's building the world, but you've got to make it seem as if you're building the world, otherwise God doesn't do anything. And that's why we learn it here. Once we've learned it here, we don't need to know it anywhere else. And then this afternoon over lunchtime, our guests must have thought that I was very absent-minded because I wasn't really concentrating on anything, because this question was going through my mind. What was going through my mind was the following. I think my answer is correct, that this is the one place where we're taught, because this is the model of the world, and if we're taught here, then we know it for everywhere. But there's one other place it should be, and that's in the creation of the world. That's one other place where maybe one should see the same form. Even though the world was created by God, there man wasn't playing a part. But this principle and this usage, there's only one other place where it would be logical to search for the same kind of usage, a passive and an active, to indicate the relationship between man and God in the running of the world. And I was thinking and thinking and I couldn't find it. All of a sudden it struck. There is another usage. The same word is used, the same grammatical form is used with similar strangeness, and it's in the beginning of Bereshis. It says, "Vayechulu hashamayim v'ha'aretz v'chol tzvam," and the heavens and the earth and all the that went with it was completed. And what's the next sentence? "Vayechal Elokim," and God finished on the seventh day. What you're repeating? It's used the passive form already, which is strange enough. It was completed. Who completed it? God completed it. They say by Echal Elokim, say God finished. Why say first that the earth was finished as if it happened all on its own? And then a second time by Echal Elokim. And of course the famous question of why it's by Echal Elokim by Yom HaShvi'i, why it says that he finished on the seventh day. The seventh day was the day he rested. He finished on the sixth day. And there are various answers on that one. There's a very well-known sefer was written a long time ago called the Akedas Yitzchak, which is an extremely difficult sefer, and it's the first time that I've looked into it. And he not only points out this difficulty in Vayechulu, but he mentions in Bereshis that it's similar to the difficulty we have in our Sedra today, in Pekudah. And he says the following. He says in the creation of the world, there are three parts to it. This is brilliant and very deep, so listen carefully. He says the first part of the creation is the creation of matter ab initio. To create matter out of nothing, that's the first thing that has to be done. Because before God started, there was nothing. So the first thing, he had to create matter. And you remember from the Chumash Yerim that that's all he did, that's all that he really created ab initio, was an atom of matter. Right? The simplest atom is all that he created. And you remember we had the machlokes of the Tanoim as to whether he in fact created energy first or he created matter first. But that doesn't matter according to Einstein, which came first. So we'll leave it. It makes no difference. It does matter. It doesn't matter, you're right. It makes no difference according to Einstein whether he created matter or energy first. But that's the only creation that was ab initio. That's the only thing that he created from nothing. That's the first stage. The second stage of the creation was to develop that little atom into all the different things we have in the world. He had to make trees and flowers and grass and birds and fish and animals and people and everything else out of that little atom. That was the second stage of creation. Says the Akedah, the first stage of creation, the creation of that little atom of matter from nothing, that was at the beginning of the first day. That was finished. The first stage of creation was then finished. The second stage of creation started immediately after that and continued until the end of the sixth day. Right? That's when God made out of that atom all the other things that we have in the world. He made the fish and the birds and the beasts and the flowers and the grass and the trees and everything else that we have, the oxygen that we breathe, water, everything was created from that between the first day and the sixth day, the end of the sixth day. At that point we're told Vayechulu hashamayim v'ha'aretz v'chol tzva'o. The world was now fully created, it was now complete. But God wasn't finished yet. It couldn't say God finished the creation. Because now we have a strange few moments in history, says the Akedah. We have a few moments where the world's creation is finished, but God's creating is not yet finished. What's missing? Erev Shabbos, what was missing? The whole world was complete. What was missing? Says the Akedah. I'll give you an example and then you'll understand what the Akedah says. Imagine I find myself with a lot of money, millions of rands, and I decide to put up a very big factory with millions of rands. Figure with this amount of money, I can get the best equipment and the most modern equipment, and I can get the best engineers to construct and design the equipment for me, and I'll have a wonderful factory. And so I start working, and I make inquiries as to where I'm going to find the best engineers in the world for this particular thing, and I find that they're in some distant city, and I get onto a plane and I travel to them and I tell them what I want. They listen, they study it, and they draw up an initial plan of it, go back, have a look at the plan, seems right, they explain what they conceive, we discuss it, put it together again. A few months later they write to me, they've got a second plan ready, they send it over, discuss it, meet with them, modify it slightly. This goes on for a few years, because if we're going to invest so much money, we're going to do it properly. By the time the plans are finished, we've got a perfect factory that's going to work. Everything is up to date, modern, and the most beautiful and most efficient there can be. Then comes to ordering the machinery, and they advise me who to order it from and who to have it and where to have it made, and I organize all that, and I wait a few more months, and I go to the factory that's making the machinery, and I watch, and everything is developing very nice, it's all beautiful. And then I get a letter that the machinery is now ready, and we decide to ship it out, and I wait for the ship to arrive, and it comes up to my factory, and then the engineers who designed it, as well as the people from the factory who made it, come out, and they help assemble it, and they put it up, and weeks of work, day and night, constructing and knocking and putting the thing together. All of a sudden they phone me, I should come over, come and have a look, and the warehouse there is full of this beautiful shiny machinery. Fantastic. Dreams of years have suddenly come true. There it is. The machinery is complete. But is the engineer's job over? No. He's got to turn the key, and he's got to show me that it can work. And when is it really complete? Not even when he turns the key and it works. It's complete when I see him off to the airport, and I say, thank you very much, that was a beautiful job, you can go now. That's when his work is complete. The Ribbono Shel Olam only completed his work when he could rest. When he could rest and leave the world to run itself, then the Ribbono Shel Olam's work was complete. That's what the Akedah says, and it's unbelievably beautiful. That Menucha, God's resting, was the greatest act of the whole creation. The fact that he could rest meant the world was now complete. After the first stage of creation, there was nothing. He created matter out of nothing. That's a wonderful creation, but it can't be used. After the second stage of creation, he created the whole world. Everything that there is in the world was perfect. It was shining, it was glittering. Everything was in its right place. But it wasn't working yet. When is the thing working? When the Creator can take a step away and can cease his support for it and can rest, and the thing carries on working with its own dynamics. That's when the thing is complete. And when we talk about success in what we do, that's what we mean. To create something that needs my constant attention, that's not a creation. That's a millstone around my neck. A creation is to create something which can stand on its own. And it makes no difference in what area one's creating. If one's creating a business, or one's creating a yeshiva, or one's creating a thought, if I have to keep on explaining it, and I can't stop explaining it, because the moment I stop, people don't understand it, that's not a thought that can stand on its own. That's not a creative thought. A creative thought is a thought which can stand on its own, can be expressed, and then there it is, and it can be used with other thoughts. It can be stand on its own 2 feet ultimately. It's proved, it's logical, and it's acceptable. And so it is with anything that one creates. One must be able to leave it alone to stand on its own feet. One must be able to withdraw from it. And if one can't withdraw from it, it's not complete. That's one of the difficult stages in a parent's bringing up of their children. They suffer the pain of when the child can stand on his own 2 feet. When the child goes off and gets married, we talked about it last week or the week before, they get very upset. The child can suddenly manage without the parents. Sometimes it happens earlier when the child takes his first walk off to school. I know parents who follow the children to school because they can't, not because the children need the parents, because the parents can't bear to think that the child can manage to go to school without them. It's a very painful thing to see the child off walking down the road quite happily. Doesn't need the parents, says goodbye and goes to the friends and comes back at the end of the day as happy as anything. It's painful for a parent. It's painful for a parent only if the parent doesn't know what they're doing. But if a parent understands that what they've got to do is to get that child to stand on their own 2 feet, and that's the function of a parent. and that the greatest excitement is when I can take a step back and my child can carry on functioning normally, that's fulfillment as a parent, then it's a big simcha when my child walks off. And the earlier he can do that, the more successful I've been. That's creation. And creation was expressed and it occurred on Shabbos, because that was the day that the Ribbono Shel Olam took a step back. The Akedah explains further for those who can understand it. That's why Shabbos is so important as an act of belief of Emunah. Because, says the Akedah, what happened after Shabbos? Sunday morning, what did God do? Did He start working again? No. For God it's still Shabbos. There were 6 days of creation, and from there on it was one eternal Shabbos then for God. He didn't go back to creating ever again. The world is operating now the same way as it did that Shabbos. Right? Therefore, says the Akedah, by understanding a Shabbos, what we're saying is that the natural running of the world operating in accordance with nature, was something which only started on Shabbos. The first 6 days was different. What was different? God was actively creating. And that's an affirmation of belief. Because you can't start the Torah until you believe that God created the world from nothing. That's Bereishis Bara Elokim Es HaShamayim Ves HaOretz. Those are the first words of the Torah. That's where it all starts. And the way we affirm that belief is to keep Shabbos. Because by keeping Shabbos, we're saying that the concept of Shabbos is not that work is not done. The concept of Shabbos is that work is done without me. I always say a time switch, not only is it the electric time switch something one's allowed to use on Shabbos. I say the electric time switch is a beautiful illustration of what Shabbos is really all about. But I should have the comfort of the lights going on and off without having to do anything myself. That's Shabbos. That my food should be cooked without having to cook it myself on Shabbos. That's Shabbos. It's not that one doesn't have any work. It's that the work is all done before. That on Shabbos things happen by themselves. It's all programmed. Shabbos has got to be programmed. And the whole world became programmed after that first Shabbos. But for the first 6 days it wasn't programmed. For the first 6 days, each step of the way, God was creating it step by step. God was doing it all on His own. And that, says the Akedah, is the pshat in a very strange medrash in Bereishis, where the medrash says the following. Tani Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai learned, Omro Shabbos lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shabbos came with a claim against God. Ribbono Shel Olam, he said, Shabbos said, Lekulon yesh ben zug veli ein ben zug. Every day of the week has a mate, and I don't have a mate. I'm all on my own. Omar LeHaKadosh Baruch Hu, Knesset Yisrael hi ben zugcha. Don't worry, the Jewish people, they are your mate. Bekivan she'omdu Yisrael lifnei Har Sinai, and when the Jews stood at Har Sinai, Omar LeHem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Zichru Adova she'amati l'Shabbos. Do you remember what I told Shabbos? Knesset Yisrael hi ben zugcha, that the Jewish people are going to be your mate. Hainu dibu, that's what the commandment means, which says Zochor es Yom HaShabbos l'Kadsho. What does all that mean? What does it mean Shabbos doesn't have a mate? Who's Sunday's mate? And who's Monday's mate? And who's Tuesday's mate? So one Midrash learns that Sunday's mate is Monday, and Tuesday's mate is Wednesday, and Thursday's mate is Friday, and Shabbos hasn't got a mate. That's altogether a difficult Midrash to understand. But just our Midrash, which is difficult enough, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, what does it mean? It says the Akedah, what it means is Shabbos is complaining that it's too passive. A ben zug, the Akedah explains on the Gavra Chetzer principle, when there are two parties to a relationship, it makes no difference. One is active and one is passive, but out of the relationship something happens. Either the subject operates on the object to produce something, or it's the other way around, but the two parties to the relationship, by being subject and object respectively, manage to produce something meaningful. Says the Shabbos, Sunday you created heaven and earth, Monday you created the lights, whatever it was, water, Tuesday you created this, Wednesday, each thing you operated on me, you handled the day in order that I should produce a new creation. Sunday had something to produce, Monday to produce, Tuesday to produce. What do you do on Shabbos? You disappear. That's it, off you go. Everybody's resting on Shabbos. Says Shabbos, that's not what I want to be. I want to be dynamic and creative, like Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. And even after the Bria, on Sunday, Monday, etc., all the days of the week, people are busy, they're active, they're achieving, they're doing things. What are they doing on Shabbos? They're sleeping and eating. That's not what I want, says Shabbos. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's not what the Jews are meant to be doing with Shabbos altogether. Shabbos, by keeping Shabbos, they're creating the concept of understanding that the world was created ab initio. But the way the world operates today is not the way it used to operate, and that's the first principle of all their intellectual investigations thereafter. And they relearn that every Shabbos. And that's what's important about Shabbos. Those are the three levels of creation, and that's why it says Vayechulu, the objective world was completed before Shabbos. But by a Chalelokim, God could only complete it when He could withdraw, which is after the completion of the objective world. And Nakeda just says it's similar to the case that we have in Pekudei, but we now have to understand the case of Pekudei a little bit better. In Pekudei 2, or in the whole construction of the Mishkan over the last several weeks, you have the three stages of the erection of the Mishkan. The first stage is bringing the raw materials, Parshas Truma. Everybody had to bring the gold and the silver and the copper and everything else that had to be brought. That was the creation of the raw materials for the erection of the Mishkan. It was stage one. Stage two was the designing and molding of that raw material into the objects of the Mishkan. They had to take the gold and make it into the menorah. They had to take the copper and make it into the kiyor and into the mizbeach. They had to take all the various things and they had to weave them into the different curtains and coverings and everything that had to be done. They had to take the raw material and mold that raw material into the various objects, exactly parallel to the creation of the world. The first stage, having the raw material. The second stage, molding that raw material into the various things that make up a world or that make up a Mishkan. But now comes the important part, making the thing work. Now when it says Vayokem Moshe es HaMishkan, and Moshe established the Mishkan, one has to read from there on until the end of the Sedra, because there it describes what he did to establish the Mishkan, and it goes through every detail. Vayitein es Adonov, and he put up the pillars. Vayosem es Kroshov, and he put the beams over the pillars. Vayitein es Brichov, and he put the various sections in. Vayokem es Amudov, and the other pillars he put up. Vayifresh es HaOil al HaMishkan, and he put the covering over the Mishkan, and so on, every detail. He brings the Aron in and he puts the Shulchan into its correct position, and he puts the Lechem, the bread, onto the Shulchan, and he puts the Menorah there and he lights the Menorah, he puts the candles in the Menorah, he puts the golden Mizbeach where it has to be, and he brings a sacrifice, he starts using the Mishkan already, and so on. And then he puts the Kiyor in its place, he then establishes the Chotzer, the yard, and finally Vayechas Ha'onon Es Oel Moed. When everything was finished, the cloud came down and covered the Yohel Moed. It was working. That was the important thing to see, that after everything was in its place, miraculously this cloud came and covered the Yohel Moed. V'lo yochol Moshe lavo el Yohel Moed. And Moshe was not permitted to come to the Yohel Moed. He had to withdraw. Once it's working, once the cloud's coming down, Moshe moves away. The Mishkan is now operating with its own dynamics. It can stand on its own two feet. Now when we talk about Vayokem es HaMishkan, about establishing or erecting the Mishkan, we're talking about it on two levels. We're talking about it on its physical level, just that the building should stand. And we're talking about it also in the level that it should operate, that it should be functional. Rashi, the Rashi that I quoted to you earlier, which is the Rashi that I quoted to the ladies this morning, really talks about it only in its physical sense. The people couldn't put up the Mishkan themselves. It was too heavy. They came to Moshe. Moshe said to God, "How am I going to put it up?" And God said, "Make it busy with it and I'll help you. It'll be alright." And that's really what it means. Then, Hukam HaMishkan. So now, using the Akedah's principle, we've got to understand the two psukim slightly differently. Be'echad l'chodesh, Hukam HaMishkan. The Mishkan was now erect. The Mishkan, from its point of view, was now complete. There was no more manufacturing or designing that was needed. Every little screw and every little hook of the Mishkan was complete and was ready and was in place. Vayokem Moshe es HaMishkan. Moshe established the Mishkan, that means that Moshe made the Mishkan functional. Moshe got the Mishkan moving in its own dynamics that he could withdraw. Because when the Mishkan was hukam, when the Mishkan was established passively, it was very nice, the building was there, but there was no cloud on it. God wasn't there, the Shekhinah wasn't there, the Mishkan wasn't working. It's like after I've ordered all my machinery and I turn the key and nothing happens. That's when Moshe had to come in. And Moshe said to God, now taking it a little bit more metaphorically, what can I do? How am I going to do anything here? Nobody can make this thing work. Says God, you just get busy putting everything in place, I'll make it work. And so he does, the cloud comes down, and lo yochol Moshe. Moshe was now not allowed to come anywhere near the oil. He had to withdraw because the Mishkan was now operating correctly on its own. So there we have the three levels of creation, and particularly the last level, which is the most important of all, which is making the thing work. That's the success of the whole venture. The bringing the donations is not going to help if it doesn't work. Designing the menorah and the shulchan and the mizbeach and everything else and manufacturing them isn't going to help if it's not going to work. Ultimately, the thing has to work. And working means that it can stand on its own 2 feet and it can operate with its own dynamics. And what I want to look at very briefly is, what is it that is needed for these three areas of creation? If one looks at it simply, it seems quite simple, really. The first area of creation is to have the raw material. You either have it or you don't. If you have it, you have it. That's all there is to it. It's a matter of having the goods. That's the first thing. If you don't have the goods, then you've got to lower your level of operation. Then your first operation is to acquire the goods. And then you've got to make sure that you have the tools you need to acquire the goods. And if you don't have the tools, you've got to lower your operation still lower, and you've got to establish an operation to acquire the tools to acquire the goods. But the first thing, when you've defined your operation, the first thing you've got to know is that you have the goods. That's number one. If you've got the goods, you can start moving. Simple as that. The second one, you need more than that. Now you've got the goods, you've got to do something with the goods. For that you need brains. For that you need chokhmah. And you need two types of chokhmah. You need knowledge. You need to have the experience and the knowledge of what to do with the goods. And in addition to that, you need adaptability. Because no one situation is like another. And if you're going to make something work, you have to be able to be adaptable. You've got to be able to know the principles and apply the principles in changing situations, because they're always going to change. What about the third one? So now you've got the goods, and you're clever, and you're adaptable, so you start working. Does it mean you're necessarily going to succeed? Unfortunately not. There are many clever people who've got the goods who lose the money, who can't make a go of it. And there's some people who are not that clever who manage somehow to make a go of it. The third element of being successful, of getting the thing to work, that's siyata dishmaya. That you can do that much, that's all, but whether the thing is going to work, whether it's going to be successful or not, that's not in your hands. You've got to do as much as you can. You've got to have the goods, and you've got to have the adaptability and the seichel, and you've got to work and apply yourself. Once you're doing all that, you may or may not succeed depending on siyata dishmaya. That depends on the Ribbono Shel Olam from there on. What we've got to understand is, what do you need to ensure the siyata dishmaya? Because then we'll have the whole thing sorted out, then it'll be simple. But before we do that, is it so clear that the first stage is just to have the goods? You've just got to have the material. What happens if you've got the material, but the material is earned dishonestly? Isn't that for sure going to affect the siyata dishmaya later on? In other words, it's true that the first level is very simple, and it's a very physical level. You've just got to have the goods. But doesn't there have to be a bit more to it than that spiritually? Doesn't it have to be quality goods, and quality not just in terms of physical quality, but in terms of spiritual quality as well? So let's have a look at the three stages of the creation in the Mishkan and what was required in terms of quality. The first stage was at the beginning of Parshas Truma, where it said, "Daberu b'nei Yisrael v'yikchu li truma," and they should take donations for me. "Me'es kol ish asher yidvenu libo," from each man who is motivated by his heart, "tikhu is truma," so you should take my truma. Says Rashi two things. V'yikchu li truma, li lishmi. That has to be for my own name. It's got to be lishmo. and this is very important, the first requirement, even on the lowest level, that's just where you're getting the goods, is that the purpose of your venture is l'shem shemayim. That's it. You're doing because you believe it's right, not because it's in your interests, or not because it's in somebody else's interests. You're doing it because you believe it's right. It's l'shem shemayim. That's got to be the first thing. Even on the basic stage of collecting your goods, you've got to make sure that in giving your goods, in setting up your, in setting yourself up, you're doing it l'shem shemayim. That's number one. Number two, what is Me'ed Kol Ish Asher Yidvenu Libo mean? Says Rashi, Hu Lashon Ratzon Tov. That means a good will. Asher Yidvenu Libo, a person who is motivated by their heart. That means you're emotionally interested in doing it and in making it succeed. It's not just something you've calculated, this might be a good idea. You have an emotional interest in making it work. You're motivated because you're not only are you doing it because you think it's right, but because you feel and believe it's right as well. Your heart tells you it's something that has to be done, and it's lishmo, you're doing it for the right reason. The very, very basis has to be on that principle. Before you move off square one, you have to be sure that these two requirements are there, that it's lishmo, you're doing it because you believe it's right, and you're doing it with emotional involvement. You're doing it because you really feel it's right and believe it's right, not just because you've calculated it's right. So we see that you need more than just having the goods. You've got to have the goods with the right attitude towards the whole venture. Otherwise it's not going to succeed. The Mishkan wouldn't have succeeded if anybody had donated something without being feeling emotionally committed, or if anybody had donated something feeling that they're doing it for ulterior motives other than strictly lishmo, because it's the right thing to do. Comes to the designing and the making of those things into the various parts of the Mishkan, that they couldn't do. That could only be done by Bezalel. Not everybody can make a success even if they've got the right goods. You need a bit of seichel. And in introducing Bezalel to us, we're told, God says, I've called Bezalel by name, he's the man who's going to do this particular function. And I'm going to fill him with the Spirit of God. He's going to have Chochma, Tvuno, which is Bino, and Das. Says Rashi, what do those words mean? Bechochma. Chochma is Ma She'odom Shomea Dvorim Me'acherim Velomed. Chochmah is the acquired knowledge. That's the first thing you need. There's no way that a human being in his short lifetime can build up enough knowledge to operate on the basis of his own experience. He has to rely on others who've already made progress and acquire their experience the shortest way possible. That's by learning from others. As we've discussed over the last few weeks, the element of trust. If one doesn't have trust for others, it's impossible to learn from them. One has to take certain people who've already gone the route and trust that they've gone it successfully and learn of what they know. That's number one. Chokhmah, one has to develop knowledge. Tvuno, mevin dovar mi liboy mitoch dvorim shelomed. Tvuno is already moving into the intuitive field. To understand something from your own heart, from the things you've already learned. To know what you've learned so well that you can extend those principles further into new areas. That's an intuitive application of the knowledge which you already have. And that's adaptability. You have some people who have wonderful memories and they can remember everything and they know whatever they've learned. But if you ask them to live it and to apply it in a situation which they haven't learned precisely, they're at a loss. They can't do it. They don't have tvuno. Tvuno is the ability to understand the principle so clearly that you have a feeling for it and can automatically adapt that principle to whatever situation happens to confront you. That's tvuno. And das, das is Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh is seeing the world from God's viewpoint, kind of. Ruach HaKodesh is a very high level. It's a spark of intuition and inspiration, something which enables one to see the world as it really is, not from down here, but to see it from up there. And Ruach HaKodesh is not something which is completely beyond people. You remember the famous Brisa, I'll just take another desire from there, isn't it? Okay. Ruach HaKodesh is something which everybody can achieve, and relatively easily. Remember the braisa on which the Mesilas Yesharim is based. Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair says, Torah mevi'a lidei zehirus. If you learn Torah properly, an automatic consequence of that is that one starts becoming more particular, more discerning, and more careful about the things that one's doing to make sure that they're right. It's automatic. You don't have to work on it. If you're learning Torah properly, the next step is that automatically it affects the meticulousness with which you perform your mitzvahs. Zehirus mevi'a lidei zrizus. Once you're being meticulous about your mitzvahs, automatically you start finding yourself being much more dynamic in your development and in your mitzvahs as well. Not only are you careful now not to do anything wrong, but you start becoming dynamically involved in doing right and in doing good. Automatically. Started with Torah, that's the only thing you had to make an effort to do, to learn. Once you're learning Torah properly, automatically comes the Zehirus, and later on, it might be a long time later on, but later on comes the Zrizus. Zrizus mevi'a lidei Nekius. After Zrizus, automatically you start coming to Nekius. Nekius is where you start purifying your mind even. That not only are your actions good and clean and nice, but there's nothing unpleasant or ugly associated mentally even with your actions. They're done l'shem shamayim. Then the kiyus mevi'a lidei precious. The next thing is, you find that you need the world as a crutch anymore. Precious is when you live in the world and you operate in the world, but you don't lean on the world. You're not dependent on it anymore. Precious mevi'a lidei taro. Precious then brings you to purity. Taro mevi'a lidei chassidus. Chassidus mevi'a lidei anova. Anova mevi'a lidei yiratchet. Yiratchet mevi'a lidei kedusha, to holiness. And Kedusha mevi'a lidei Ruach HaKodesh. It's all a natural chain of result of learning properly. If one starts off learning properly over a period of many years, all this just happens automatically. Just flows one from the other. And ultimately one can find that one's in a situation of Ruach HaKodesh. That doesn't mean that one's a prophet. But that means that at times one's able to see things in a way which is far beyond the normal human way of looking at things. One's able to see it with a flash of inspiration which gives one a clarity which normally people don't manage to achieve. That's Ruach HaKodesh. And those are the three elements which one needs for the second stage of creation. One needs Chochmah, one needs to have experience and background, knowledge. One needs Tvuna, which is the ability to be adaptable with that knowledge. And one needs Ruach HaKodesh. But it'll be a flashes of inspiration as well. But then comes the most important one of the lot. And that's, what do you need for the last level? For Moshe Rabbeinu's level. Why was Moshe the only one that could put up the Mishkan? Says the Medrash on the Sedra. Vatischak l'yom acharon. What does it mean in Tanakh? Where it says, on the last day you will laugh. Eilu leitzonei Yisrael, these were the jokers of Israel, shemelitzin acharo, they used to joke after Moshe, v'omrim eilu le'eilu, and they used to say to one another, efshar shashchina shorei al yodov shel ben Amram. Is it possible that this old Ben Amram, Moshe, well into his 80s, he's going to build the Mishkan by himself, he's going to do it. Let's see this thing happen. They used to laugh about it. Lo yaso. Moshe neglected it, he ignored it, he didn't respond to their jokes. But when God said, okay Moshe, it's time to put the thing together, and then he started laughing at them. As it says, and you laugh on the last day. He said to them, he said, come everybody, let's put the Mishkan together. They started trying to lift things up, and they came. As it says earlier on, Mishkan. It says they brought the Mishkan to Moshe, and then it says they brought the beams and the screws and the bolts and the sides and all the pieces they brought to him. Why didn't they bring in the complete Mishkan? They couldn't do it. Kama chachomim ayusham. How many wise people were there? Uvol lahem etzel Moshe. And they all had to come to Moshe, v'loy ayu yecholim lahakimoy, and they couldn't make this machine work. And that's when Moshe had his last laugh. And if they tried to put the machine, the Mishkan together, all 600,000 of them couldn't do it, and Moshe himself could do it. What is it? What was the koyach that Moshe had which they didn't have? And the answer is hinted in the very Midrash that I've just read to you. The Gemara says in Bava Metzia, Daf Pei Zayin Amud Aleph 87a, Omer Rabbi Elozer, said Rabbi Elozer, Mikan, from here we learn, Shetzadikim Oimrim Ma'at Ve'oisim Harbe, Tzadikim say little and they do a lot. Rishoyim Oimrim Harbe Ve'afilu Ma'at Einam Oisim, and Rishoyim say a lot and they don't even do a little. That's what the Gemara says. The Gemara is explaining to us one of the many differences between a tzaddik and a rosha. How do you identify them? One of the ways is by noting the relationship between what they undertake and what they finally do. The difference between a tzaddik and a rosha, not just an optimist and a pessimist, or a person with a good heart and a bad heart. This is the difference between a tzaddik and a rosha. Minalan, the Ephraim on the Torah learns this out from various places, from Avram and from Ephraim. The Gemara learns it out. What does it mean? The Tel Zerov explains very beautifully what it means, and this of course explains also the famous saying in Pirkei Avot, Emor mi'at v'yaseh harbeh. And the correct translation of that is not say little and do much, as the English translates it. The correct translation is say little so that you will do much. That's what it is. Explains the Tel Zerov very beautifully. He says, a tzaddik understands that nothing in the world works on its own. He understands reality. He doesn't have an overinflated opinion of himself. He knows his own limitations. He knows the distractions. He knows how busy he is. He knows how much he's got to do. He knows how difficult it is to do anything. And he finds it difficult to make undertakings. He finds it difficult to say, I'm going to do such and such, because he doesn't know he's going to be able to manage. He sees in reality and in perspective the problems and difficulties of achievement and of success. And to say he's going to do it, if he doesn't believe he can do it, that's also no good. So oimrim ma'at, tzaddikim oimrim ma'at, they say little. So you'll say to a tzaddik, the example I gave to the ladies this morning, you'll say to a tzaddik, can you give me a lift to the airport tomorrow? Tzaddik will say, I'll do my best, I'll try. And if you know him, you'll know that that means he'll do it, but he'll only say, I'll try. If you say to a rosha, can you give me a lift to the airport tomorrow? He says, sure, no problem. Now, at that point, we would think that they're the other way around. The guy who says, let's say an old man comes to you and says, please, can you give me a lift to the airport tomorrow? You say, I'll try. And somebody else says, sure I will. Who's the tzaddik and who's the rosha? One would say that the one who said, sure he will, is the tzaddik, and the one who said, I'll try, is the rosha. No. The one who said, I'll try, understands the problems. He knows how much he's got to do tomorrow. He knows how difficult it is to get there in time, and to go out and fetch the old man and to take him there and then to come back, and what he's got to cancel tomorrow because of having to do that, and how's he going to manage, and all the things that have to be done. And in any case, his car isn't working, so he's going to have to get up 2 hours earlier to repair his car. It's going to be very difficult. The Rosha doesn't think that way. The Rosha says, sure, I'll do it, I'll find a way, it'll be alright, I can do anything, don't worry, leave it to me, I'll organize it. Comes half an hour before the time to go, and the old man gets a telephone call from the tzaddik. He says, right, my car's fixed, I'm on the way. Gets a telephone call from the rosha, I'm running a little bit late. I didn't know that I didn't have any petrol in my car, and I've just got to go and get some from something. I'll be there soon, hang on, wait for me. And he goes and he phones again 15 minutes later. He says, you know, I didn't realize it was Sunday today, not so easy to get petrol, and I've been around to one of my friends, just hang on where you are, I'll be there as soon as I can, I'm going to another friend. And so he goes and so he goes, and the poor old man loses the plane. Says the Tel Zerov, a tzaddik looks at an achievement before he starts, and it's a mountain. It's impossible. If despite its difficulty he says, yes, I'll do it, why does he do it? Not because he thinks it's easy to do. He knows it's difficult to do. He says, I'll do it because he believes it has to be done, and because he believes in God. If a tzaddik didn't believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam, he wouldn't move out of his house. He would stay locked up all day and he would starve to death. Because he wouldn't believe anything was possible. A tzaddik, a person who knows how the world works and knows the difficulties and knows his own limitations, he wouldn't believe that anything could be achieved, so he would stay at home. What compensates the tzaddik's knowledge of reality, which would depress him, is his belief in God. Okay, things are difficult out there, but I believe it's the right thing. It has to be done. I have no choice, but we've got to go. when the Jews were cornered by the sea, they had to go into the sea. There was no choice, so they walked into the sea. The sea split. And they didn't know it was going to split when they started walking, but they knew they had no choice. This is what you have to do. So a tzaddik has clarity. He knows what has to be done. He knows what has to be done, and he starts doing it. And why is he doing it? Because it has to be done, not because it's easy, not because he thinks he can manage. He's worried that I can't manage, but I'm doing it because it has to be done. Then God helps. If that's what you're doing, that means you're worried and you need my help and you're not sure that you'll manage, but you're just doing it for me, says God, then I'll help. And that's why Osim Harbe. They say a little because they're worried, but when they get busy doing and God helps them, an awful lot happens, and it happens much quicker and much more effectively than it happens with a Rosha. But the Rosha, if he thinks something's difficult, he doesn't do it. The trouble of being a Rosha is that nothing's difficult. As easy as he thought. And the reason it's not as easy as he thought is because he doesn't have the Siyata Dishmaya. God says to him very simply, fellow, you said yes, somebody asked you to take them to the airport, and you said, sure, no problem. Why were you so sure it was no problem? Because you think you can do it. You don't need me for it even, so do it yourself. And when a man is left to do something himself without God's help, it's very difficult. And oisim ma'at, or according to the Gemara, afilu ma'at einam oisim, they don't even manage a little bit. Because without siyata dishmaya, there's nothing you can do at all. And that was the element that Moshe Rabbeinu had. And that's in fact intimated in the Rashi itself. That was the midah that Moshe had. Says Rashi, Amar Moshe lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Moshe said to God, Eich efshar hakamotsu al yidei odom, how can a human being build the Mishkan, put it up? How's it possible? Everybody's tried and they can't. How am I going to do it? That's the key to success. The moment Moshe realized that he can't do it, that's the key that he will do it. Says God, Asik ato biyodecho, get busy, start. Nira kamei kimo, it'll look as if you're doing it. Vahu nizka fakamma elov, and don't worry, it'll all get done automatically. That's the essence of hishtadlus, of making an effort. If you start off believing it's difficult, and you need siyata dishmaya, and you're mispalo for siyata dishmaya, you ask the Ribbono Shel'olam, help me, I can't do it myself. It's too big. Even the little things we have to do. But nevertheless, I'll get busy and do it because I have no option. It has to be done. Then you've got all the rights in the world to expect the Ribbono Shel'olam to help, and he does help, and niskafa kamel of it all just happens automatically. That's the beauty of it, and that's what you need for the third element of creation. You need anova, just the knowledge of your own limitations vis-a-vis the challenges that stand before you. And when you know your own limitations but the challenges, don't get depressed and back out. That would be what a coward would do. Knowing your own limitations and the challenges, ask yourself, is this what has to be done? Are there more important things to do now? If the answer is no, this is what must be done, roll up your sleeves and start doing. And the Ribbono Shel'olam steps in to help. That's what it is. Those are the three areas of creation. For the first one, we need the raw material with a purity of intention. You're doing it lishma, and you're emotionally committed. For the second, you need seichel. You need chokhmah, you need knowledge and adaptability, mental flexibility, as well as a bit of ruach hakodesh. You need to be on a certain spiritual level. For the third stage, for the stage of success of making the thing work, that no human being can do. Nobody can make a thing work, because that's creation, and creation only God can do. If you know that before you start, God will help you make it work. If you don't know that before you start, he'll leave it to you and you'll make a mess of it. Those are the levels, and that's the way it works. And we see that our initial assumption was quite right. The concept of this Hukam HaMishkan, the fact that the Mishkan can be built physically and still by Yakem Moshe still has to work at it, that is repeated somewhere else. And it is repeated with the Bria, with the creation of the world. We now understand why the melochas, the work that one isn't allowed to do on Shabbos, what is that? That's the work they used to do in the Mishkan. Because the whole principle of not working on Shabbos is to try and relive God's Shabbos. And God's Shabbos was standing back after the completion of the world, standing back to see if it could work. What was the equivalent Shabbos, the only other one mentioned in the Torah, the only other situation where the passive and the active are used together to show that same concept which the Akedah has taught us. The other one is the Mishkan. Having done all the physical creation, the test was by Yakim Moshe. Could Moshe now leave it alone and watch the cloud descend? And what had to stop when Moshe was at that point? All the work that had gone into the first two stages of creation had to stop. And so what we do on Shabbos is we stop those acts of creation which went into the manufacture of the Mishkan. We stop and stand back so as to relive that that lack of creativity, so to say, which God performed. And we stop doing anything which is basically, if one takes the Mishkan and one accepts the Medrash and the Tanchuma this week, that the Mishkan represents a little world, you'll find that in the manufacture of the Mishkan, that's in the first two stages of creation, all forms of technical creativity are included. All the different categories of making something technically, of creating something technically, are all included. The third stage there is the making the thing work. On Shabbos, we don't make anything technically. We like the world to work without us. And by showing that the world can work without us, we're showing the differentiation, and that's particularly stressed in Havdalah. After Shabbos, we say, right, during Shabbos, the world worked without us. Sunday, God was busy creating. A different type of creation to the one that He's busy creating now. Now it's just creation in the sense that the world can operate dynamically. But on Sunday to Friday, what God was involved was a creation from nothing. He was building up the world from nothing with a much more active involvement. And that's what we do on Shabbos. And that's why Shabbos has to be much more than a period of withdrawal. We now understand how God's withdrawal was the greatest act of creation at all, of all. To be able to stand back and watch the thing work, that was the greatest act of creation. Shabbos now forms that same function with our week. To work on a Sunday, and to work on a Monday, and a Tuesday, and a Wednesday, whether you're working at your business, or at your studies, or in the kitchen, or in the garden, whatever it is, to have to work on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and again on Thursday, and again on Friday, okay, it has to be done. But if you can never stop working, then you're unsuccessful. The whole purpose of working is to build something which can then run on its own. And Shabbos is the test. Has my work been such that I can stop for one day and I won't starve, and the garden won't become overrun with weeds, and there won't be nothing to eat in the house, and I won't fail my exams? In other words, can I build up sufficient momentum during the 6 days to create something which can stand on its own for one day? That's the test of the effectiveness of one's week. If one has to work on Shabbos too, at the same things that one's working at during the week, one knows that one's been unsuccessful during the week. That's the brocha of Shabbos, and that's the test of Shabbos. One has to be able to do in 6 days, 7 days' work. And the seventh day, one stands back to see if it can continue working. If you come back to your business on Sunday or on Monday, and you find it's in turmoil, and if you find that by the end of Shabbos you've got nothing to eat in the house, and that your garden is overgrown, and that your house is falling down, then you know that your week has been unsuccessful. Not that your Shabbos has been unsuccessful. It's your week which has been unsuccessful. The test of success is the ability to stand back and enjoy it. And if you can never enjoy what you're doing and what you're making, you might as well not waste the time of making it. That's what a Shabbos is. That's why the Shabbos was the most creative day of all. And that's the Ben Zug, that's the partner that Shabbos has. Am Yisrael are going to make out of Shabbos the greatest creation there can be. Out of Shabbos they show that the rest of their work's activities have in fact been successfully creative and have been blessed and full of profit. Are there any questions on this? Because it's an extremely difficult concept, but it's something which we're going to build on in the future times. Yeah.